In addition to the personal lifelong sense of loss associated with not having my mother, the downside of being on my own was that I received my guidance from the people on the street. Not everything they advised was wise or legal. My high school choice was basically made by Charlie, a senior playing football for Stuyvesant High School. I still recall his words of wisdom. "Go to Stuyvesant. You're not smart enough to get into Bronx science." I allowed guys like Charlie to define the limits of what I could achieve. I could beat myself up for that. I am wiser now, and can look back on my earlier years with empathy for my former self, and realize that I had a lot going on in my life emotionally, and that I had not yet figured out who I was or what I wanted. I prefer not to think of the past with regret. We all have things we're not particularly proud of, yet we can't let that fact hover over what we are capable of achieving now. It takes time to gain perspective, particularly during those formative years when we're testing our self-image against how we see other people. We must be kind to ourselves. As we leave our teenage years, the next big event in forming self-image occurs when we make a special bond with a love interest. The end result of this pairing is often marriage, or some equivalent cohabitation with a partner, and a de facto moving away from the larger group of friends. In addition, this is usually a period of personal growth in which we learn and enhance our marketable skills. We now develop a newer version of our self-image, integrating the influences from our intimate pairing and our skills training into our pictures of ourselves as autonomous adults. In my case, this manifested itself when I got married at the end of my junior year in college. I started to teach as a lecturer after I graduated the following year, and I did graduate work in the afternoons and evenings. Eventually, I earned a PhD and obtained an assistant professorship at Stanford University. Becoming autonomous. College and university professors are not usually trained how to teach. They're trained to be researchers and to mimic what their teachers have done. It can take many years before they find their own voice as teachers. To some extent, they never shake the influence of their professors entirely, just as one is never entirely free of parental or parental surrogates' influences. I had just led a full-day workshop in Taiwan titled Creative Teaching, and a young assistant professor was driving me back to my hotel. In the privacy of the car, he told me, "That was very interesting. I never thought that I could modify how I teach. I did not realize I could consider redesigning the structure of my job and actually approach the issue of how to teach as a problem-solving activity." He was visibly shaken. He had seen a yellow-eyed cat. He now understood that teaching needs to be approached from an individual perspective that is broader than simply covering specific material. Teachers need to be clear what their intention is for each class session and develop a style suited to who they are. Unfortunately, many people are in the same trap, and not only in academia. We are influenced by our teachers and parents to the extent that we spend our lives trying, as best we can, to mimic them. And all too often, we end up being second-rate replicas. One of the social functions of families and other communities to which we belong is to constrain our behavior. Normally, these social constraints serve a valid societal function, yet they can also have a big downside unless we are willing to confront and, if appropriate, discard them in a productive manner. If we realize we have a unique persona and a history different from that of our teachers and parents, we can end up being creators of a new synthesis that honors our influences, yet is also a true expression of our very being. It's important that we look at our life and work not only from the point of view of its content, but also from the question of what our actual intentions are. Your turn. Create a list of all the things you intend to accomplish with your work. You can get there by asking yourself a series of questions. What is my intention? Is it simply to get through the day? Is it to get a specific task done? Is it to have a good time? Is it to bolster my ego? Is it to delight? Is it to inspire? Is it to motivate? Or is it to escape? Then, once it's clear what your basic intentions are, the next issue is how to accomplish them. Before you get to that, it is important to be sure your intentions are real, and not simply a series of clichés that you have been programmed to recite or have created to appease your self-image. Once you have your basic intentions clear, you can view the method of implementing them as a creative problem-solving activity that will get you unshackled from past practices and mimicked constraints. If we're with someone we admire, we often start to take on some of her traits. In this way, we learn how to act from our parents, romantic partners, friends, teachers, and colleagues. Generally, this happens subconsciously. Interestingly, it is also possible to learn from them how not to be. This generally requires some conscious effort. For example, if I grow up in a house where my parents are continually fighting or mad at each other, I can note that is something I do not want to replicate in my own family. However, unless I specifically guard against it, my parents' behavior will likely surface in me when the going gets tough with my spouse. How to see yourself. In our minds, we all have pictures of what and who we are. These are collectively known as our self-image. Our interpretations of our self-image, that of our bodies, emotions, actions, and thoughts, ultimately define for us who we are. We may have an accurate self-image, or it may be way off the mark. Your turn. List 5 short, 1 or 2 word descriptors of the type of person you think you are. Ask 5 friends or family members to each also list 5 things that describe who they think you are. Then compare their 25 items with your 5 items. The amount of agreement and disagreement can give you valuable insights regarding the accuracy of your self-image. Whether or not we have an accurate self-image, it can strongly color who we are, what we do, and how we respond to the world around us. Others can use it to manipulate us, and we can use it to manipulate others. It can be largely positive or largely negative, though for most people, it is both. Often our self-image constrains what we will and will not do, or at least colors our feelings about what we have and have not done. In an ideal world, self-image would form the basis for much of what we did and did not do. In the real world, things are a bit more complicated. Using rationalization, people can justify any action or inaction in an attempt to bring it into accord with their self-image. Most of us do not have a completely realistic self-image. Harvard business psychologist Chris Argyris concluded, after 40 years of studying people, that they consistently act inconsistently, unaware of the contradiction between the way they think they are acting and the way they really act. Causing our behavior to fall in line with our self-image requires telling ourselves the truth, not lying to ourselves or rationalizing our behavior. Our self-image evolves and changes as we go through life. We may have certain inborn tendencies that get reinforced by our environment, while entirely new aspects come as the result of our experiences as we accumulate successes and failures. Thus, one of the ways we can change our behavior is to proactively change our self-image, while at the same time bringing our behavior in line with our self-image. In fully integrated people, behavior changes self-image, and self-image changes behavior throughout their lives. In the Stanford D School, we attempt to bring students through a series of experiences that change their self-image so that they think of themselves as being more creative. We call this boosting their creative confidence. Michael Jensen, Werner Erhard, and their associates use a similar concept in leadership training. They call it changing the context. Others call these types of changes reframing or changing frameworks. Whatever it's called, the psychological milieu in which we operate is important because it acts as a hidden arbitrator in how we approach many aspects of our lives. The Your Turn exercises in this chapter are designed to assist in exploring and expanding the bounds of your self-image. Your Turn. One way to look at your self-image is to make a list of your attributes. This can be done by, again, answering the question, who am I? In order to gain deeper insight, however, This time, you will look at who you are in a way that contrasts the being part of your self-image to the parts involving your possessions and your activities. As suggested in the Use Your Brain section at the end of Chapter 1, each question should be repeated for at least 5 or 10 minutes. If you have someone available to work with, you can take turns where one person repeatedly asks the same question and the other person answers. Of course, if there are two people, the questions need to be rephrased. Who are you? So ask yourself these questions. Who am I in terms of what I have? Who am I in terms of what I do? And who am I in terms of my being? This exercise gives you a chance to stop the daily chatter in your head and to look separately at what you have, what you do, and who you are. It gives you an opportunity to dig deep and see how your life is stacking up compared to your self-image. It can give you a mid-course correction or reaffirm that you are sailing in the desired direction. People often confuse who they are with their possessions, their achievements, or their jobs. The parsing of the question into three parts thus helps them to gain clarity. Every time I do this exercise, I am reminded it's more subtle than it first appears. For example, in terms of what I have, I could say a wife, 2 sons, a professorship, a house, friends, students and former students, several bicycles, a newly completed book manuscript, and hundreds of research papers. In terms of what I do, I might come up with husbanding, parenting, teaching and research, household tasks, socializing, mentoring and relating, cycling, driving, writing, and publishing. The two lists are more or less identical. None of this informs who I am in terms of my being. Or does it? Much depends on how I relate to these things. Teaching, for example, is for some people a thing they have. The teaching job is their proudest possession. I remember how astounded I was when I accompanied one of my professors to pick up his dry cleaning, and the clerk addressed him as Doctor, and later also as Professor. This was at some mom-and-pop establishment in Flushing, New York, 10 miles and light-years away from Columbia University. This is common in Europe, yet it seemed comically out of place in the context of a working-class neighborhood in New York City. It actually reinforced my sense that the poor fellow was using his job to hide who he really was. To some people, teaching is something they do. It is a job, pure and simple. That job is like any other job to them. They go to work, put their time in, and get paid. The job is purely instrumental. They work to have money to pay rent, feed their family, and subscribe to cable television. Other people are born to teach. If they did not have teaching jobs, they would still be teachers. It's their calling, an intimate part of their being. I remember reading in one of Henry Miller's early books that he and all of his friends knew he was a writer, even though, at the time, he was working as a messenger and had not yet published anything. So, depending on how I hold it, teaching could be something I have, or something I do, or part of my very being. The same is true for many things in people's lives. There is no right answer as to which category something belongs in. It all depends on you. It is important, however, to know the difference and not to confuse what you have or what you do with who you are. Knowing this increases your chances of forming a valid self-image. Some people's self-image totally identifies them with their origins. One such person is my good friend Bruno. More than most people's, Bruno's life is punctuated by adventures, which in turn are fueled by his rock-solid self-image of being a Neapolitan alpha male. This became clear to me many years ago during a conference in Linz, Austria. Several of us had gone to a disco after dinner. There were some local women sitting next to us, and Bruno asked one of them to dance. She declined, and Bruno could not believe it. He exclaimed loudly, "But I am Italian. I am from Naples." He did not give up, but kept asking her to dance, and she steadfastly refused, in spite of what he thought to be his impeccable credentials. Soon, he switched tactics and started engaging her in conversation. I lost interest and did not follow along. When we left the disco, Bruno triumphantly showed me a piece of paper saying, "She gave me her phone number." Alas, the next day when he dialed the number, he was amazed to find it was not valid. He was sure there had been an error in transcription. He could not imagine what seemed obvious to the rest of us, that she had given him a made-up number to get rid of him. I am certain she made an error, though not the one Bruno thinks she made. Her error was in not writing down her actual number. Bruno was right. He's a lot of fun. A good tool to assist in looking at who we really are is called guided fantasy. We do this by closing our eyes and creating a fantasy experience in which we examine some surrogate entity, such as a tree or a house. Then we give a detailed description of what we have seen in our fantasy. Finally, we repeat the description, this time in the voice of the surrogate object. In this way, we gain access to images of ourselves that we generally hide or are not consciously aware of. Your turn. Guided fantasy is a good tool to assist you in examining who you really are. The script I use follows. You can record yourself reading it and then lie down on the floor or any flat surface and follow its instructions as you listen to the recording. Please close your eyes. Become aware of your breathing going in and out. Notice the air temperature. Notice your chest expanding and contracting. Take your awareness from your chest to the right side of your body. Put your awareness on your right hip. Now move it down along the front of your leg to the front of your right knee. Now take your awareness down along your shin to your right ankle. Go across the top of your right foot to your smallest toe. Take your awareness across the toes on your right foot to the big toe, then up the inside of your right leg to your crotch, and then to your belly. Take your awareness to your left hip. Now move it down along the front of your left leg to the front of your left knee. Now, take your awareness down along your shin to your left ankle. Go across the top of your left foot to your smallest toe. Take your awareness across the toes on your left foot to the big toe, then up the inside of your left leg to your crotch, and then to your belly. Now take your awareness up your chest to your chin. Be aware of your breath going in and out. Notice the air temperature. Notice your chest expanding and contracting. Now imagine you were going to take a journey. Imagine standing up and going to the airport. Imagine boarding a plane for a short flight. Imagine getting off the plane and making your way to a bus. Take a short bus ride, and then imagine getting off the bus. Now, imagine a house in the distance and walk toward that house. When you get to the house, explore the outside and then the inside, examining the details carefully. Take a 10-minute pause here. Get ready to leave the house and make your return trip. First, walk back to where you got off the bus. Imagine the bus returning and take it back to the airport. Board a plane and fly back to your original airport. Then make your way back to this room. Imagine that you lie down again. Become aware of your breathing. Aware of your breath going in and out. Notice the air temperature. Notice your chest expanding and contracting. Be aware of the noises in the room. Slowly open your eyes and then get into a seated position. After a few minutes, describe in detail the house you explored. You can do this to yourself or to another person or a group of people, if available. Next, describe that house again, and this time don't speak for yourself. Speak for the house and its contents. Through you, the house and its contents are describing themselves in the first person. So, if the original story contained the words, "It was an old house with many things thrown about," the new version would be, "I am old and full of disorderly stuff." You must stay in the role of inanimate objects talking in the first person. Often what happens is quite revealing. In speaking for the house and its possessions, you are describing yourself. You have, in fact, projected many of your characteristics onto the house and its objects. This is an excellent way to look at yourself. Because you do it so indirectly, it is non-threatening. It produces candid insights that might otherwise not be available from examination of one's own self-image. Changing your self-image. Another exercise that can have a strong mind-altering effect is using your awareness to get a new perspective on your problems and your life. To do this exercise, think of an issue in your life that you would be willing to be rid of. Start by asking yourself if you are really willing to be rid of it. Are you willing to have it vanish from your life right now? This is harder than we think. It turns out that we love to hang on to some of our issues. We use them to identify who we are and to relate through them to our friends. For instance, some of us like to be seen as victims because people will show us sympathy. Assuming you find something you are truly willing to be rid of, the rest is easy. It is simply a matter of being mindful about all the things you associate with this issue. Being mindful in general implies being aware of what you are doing and not being on automatic pilot as you go through your day. There is a bit more to it, however. True mindfulness is seeing without judging. It is the equivalent of just being there and dispassionately observing what is going on and what we are doing. It is a state of being willing to just be with whatever is going on. To get to that state, it helps to pause for a moment, breathe, connect with your inner experience, and observe the world around you. Mindfulness can lead to insights and awareness. Your turn. In the 1970s, I participated in a 2-week workshop known as Erhard Seminar Training, usually abbreviated in lowercase as EST. On the second day, the group was led through an exercise called the Truth Process. I found, to my surprise, that the exercise completely eliminated an annoying habit of speech that I had picked up years earlier. I was naturally impressed, and I incorporated the exercise into my teaching. The results have been very favorable. It's a good tool for getting rid of aspects of your self-image that stand in the way of developing your achievement habit. Over time, my version of this exercise has changed. I don't run it with a written script, and each year it comes out of my mouth a bit differently. I don't think there is any critical exactness to it. The same ideas have been applied in many versions long before my first experience with the Truth Process. In this exercise, you become mindful of as many things as possible associated with a specific issue. It will work best to lie down in a quiet place and close your eyes. If you are doing this in a group, someone can lead you through it. If not, you can record the instruction and lead yourself. Once you are settled, do a short meditation to relax yourself. A good way to do this is to become aware of your breath and notice the temperature of the air going in and coming out. Then move your awareness slowly around your body. The meditation script given previously for guided fantasy works nicely. After the relaxation, think of an issue that you are willing to be rid of. The issue can have to do with a relationship in your personal or professional life, a mannerism you have, or a decision you are troubled about. It can be anything that has an impact on you on a personal level. It should not be something global like world peace or saving the planet, unless those are personal parts of a problem that you are actually dealing with. Once you have an issue you are willing to have disappear from your life, you can proceed to work through the steps, and the exercises we'll cover in just a moment. If at any time during this exercise you feel that you have rid yourself of whatever you wanted to be rid of, you can move directly to the last 2 steps in the exercise. Steps in this exercise. 1. First, in your mind's eye, create an object that represents your issue. That is, give the issue an actual physical embodiment. Imagine this object being a few feet in front of you. With your eyes closed, look at this embodiment. Become mindful of its physical properties by doing an inventory using the following questions. How tall is it? How wide is it? How deep is it? What is its color? What is its texture? What is its temperature? Does it have an odor? And what is its sound? 2. Now recall the last time this issue occurred in your life. Then recall the previous time and keep going back in time until you come as close as possible to the first time it occurred. 3. When you are finished, again, imagine that your issue's physical embodiment is a few feet in front of you, and repeat the inventory of its physical properties. Usually the object's properties will have changed slightly. 4. Now recall all the things that you are sure are correct about this issue. Don't lie to yourself. 5. When you are finished, imagine yet again that the object's physical embodiment is a few feet in front of you, and repeat the inventory of its physical properties. Note, repeat this survey of the object's properties after each of the following items. 6. Next, tell yourself all the things you think might be correct about this issue. 7. Now look at all the things you think might be incorrect about this issue. 8. Now recall all the things that happen to your body when you experience this issue. 9. What are your body positions when this issue comes up for you? 10. Do you have any physical reactions associated with this issue? 11. Now recall all the emotional states you go through when you have this experience. Think back to the actual experience, not your ideas about it. 12. Now look at all the sensations and feelings you associate with this issue. Don't lie to yourself. 13. Next, look at all the evaluations and judgments you have regarding this issue. 14. Now tell yourself all the things you get out of keeping this issue in your life. Don't lie to yourself. What does it do for you to keep this issue? 15. Now imagine being upset about this issue. Next, imagine not being upset about this issue. Again, imagine being upset and then not being upset, and repeat this about 5 times. Then imagine having an upset about this issue. Next, imagine not having an upset about this issue. Again, imagine having an upset and not having an upset, repeating about 5 times. Next, imagine being upset and then not being upset, and then having an upset and not having an upset. 16. Now imagine you are in front of a whiteboard mounted on a frame with wheels. On this whiteboard, write a list of all the things and people's names that are keeping this issue in your life. At this point, again, imagine that the object's physical embodiment is a few feet in front of you, and repeat the inventory of its physical properties for the last time. 17. Now imagine you are again in front of the whiteboard and that you have an eraser in your hand. Look over your list of what is keeping this problem in your life. Erase all things or people's names that are no longer valid. Now, imagine pushing the whiteboard up to the edge of a high precipice that has a seemingly bottomless drop on the other side. 18. Take one last look at your list. Erase anything else you want from it, and then push the board over the precipice. 19. Now imagine yourself at the beach on a nice sunny day. Do your favorite thing for a while. When you feel ready, open your eyes and slowly get up. And finally, 20. Take all the time you need to quietly digest what you went through during this exercise. Parting lessons from friends. I have always felt affection for the Welsh and Irish poets and playwrights. Dylan Thomas's poem, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night," has always resonated with me, and earlier in my life I thought of myself going to the grave kicking and screaming. Unfortunately, I have had too much contact with death to remain guided by my youthful emotions. What I have found is that death, like lives, are unique, and that if I pay attention, each death provides me some wisdom. Carl DeLue's death was a celebrated murder case. Carl was a mathematics professor and a close friend who lived on the same street as I, on the Stanford campus. We were frequent visitors to each other's homes. 2 nights before Ruth and I left on a trip, Carl and I were amusing ourselves reading bizarre ads in a Berkeley newspaper. One ad was for an audio tape that explained how to return from the dead. It came with a t-shirt. The ad's irresistible appeal was its statement, "Buy this shirt and tape. Who wants to be dead forever?" So we set away for the shirt and the tape. When Ruth and I returned from our trip, we were surprised to find Carl's wife, Sita, at the San Francisco airport to meet us. She was wearing the t-shirt Carl and I had ordered. I started to joke about the shirt when she stopped me to tell us that Carl had been murdered, bludgeoned to death by Ted Strelesky, a longtime PhD candidate in Stanford's Department of Mathematics. Strelesky felt he had not been treated fairly by the department, and he wanted to bring public attention to his case. Even though his advisor had recently told him that his work was acceptable for submission as a PhD dissertation and graduation was finally in sight, he felt his life had been ruined by the long delay in obtaining his degree. Many mathematicians had done their best work when they were young, and now he felt he was too old to become great. He was stuck in the wrong-headed view of achievement that says accolades and awards are the most important things in life. He had brainwashed himself into thinking that this was all that mattered. And because of this, he was more interested in his grievance than in his degree. He considered the standard avenues of redress, such as writing letters to newspapers, Stanford administrators, or Stanford alumni, or filing an official grievance. He decided these would not be strong enough. He concluded that he could get much greater publicity if he murdered someone prominent and then went to trial. He made a hit list of several professors in the mathematics department and then used public transportation from his apartment in San Francisco to Stanford in an incredibly circuitous route. When he finally got to Stanford, he was unable to find the first few people on his list. Then he got to Carl's name, and unfortunately Carl was in his office, grading the final exams from his summer class. Strelesky had brought a small sledgehammer and used it to murder Carl. He then left undetected. A few days later, he surrendered to the police. His idea was to plead not guilty and have a trial that would be covered by the press. During his trial, he planned to have members of the mathematics department faculty on the witness stand and question them so as to publicly reveal practices that he felt were abusive. He succeeded, to a certain degree. He got publicity, and there was some linking of his case to the general plight of PhD students as a political underclass. This incident was a prime example to me of the weakness of pure logic. Strelesky's logic was impeccable in terms of his desire to get the most publicity for his case, except he forgot the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." Unfortunately, this kind of omission is much too prevalent in decision-making at various levels of our society. Strelesky was just another tragic example. I went to the trial every day. Strelesky pleaded not guilty, even though he admitted committing the murder, as well as having planned to do it, using the sledgehammer he brought with him. His lawyer wanted him to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. Strelesky refused because he did not want to be regarded as insane. He wanted to convince the media that the murder was logically and morally correct, and that it was a political statement about the department's treatment of its graduate students. Here was a bright man who could have had a good life had he not been so fixated on what he felt was owed him. If he couldn't have his perfectly planned life as a math genius, then he would make people pay. In doing so, of course, he made himself miserable too. There is no degree, award, job, or referral worth dying or killing for. Of course, most people are not murderers, and this is an extreme case, yet it highlights the danger of being too rigid in your view of what your life path should be. Life will throw you curveballs. If you adapt, you can find happiness in any situation. My close colleague Rolf Fasta's death was remarkable in that he did not follow the expected knee-jerk reaction of seeking survival at any price. To be a traditional achiever, you're supposed to fight for your life. Rolf didn't really care about what others thought, however. His achievements would be on his own terms. After he was diagnosed with stomach cancer, he noticed that when he visited his regular doctor, the experience left him feeling bad. When he went to his Zen master, he came home feeling good. He resolved to treat his body as a sacred gift and not to poison it in the name of survival. He made it clear he did not welcome visitors advising him to seek standard chemotherapy or radiation treatments. He spent his time quietly meditating and in positive conversations with his family and friends. He died according to the same principles he had lived by. By contrast, another colleague, who was a difficult person, totally changed while undergoing hospice care. He was not someone I was close to. We had a cordial relationship, even though I did not enjoy his company. After he got sick, I went to visit him at home out of obligation. To my surprise, he had changed and was now engaging to be with. I ended up visiting him frequently. Other colleagues started coming regularly to visit. We all found him to now be a very attractive companion. Finally, close to death, he had stopped posturing and was simply there with us. It was a pity he had to be dying before he felt free to be at ease with his true self. He and everyone around him would have had a better life if he had arrived there sooner. Bill Mogridge was a close friend who had a strong sense of self and was extremely independent. Nobody could get him to wear a bicycle helmet, even when he came roaring down the mountain, passing cars on blind turns. When he asked himself the question, "Who are you?" that's what he came up with. He decided how he wanted to live his life and didn't let anyone interfere. When he became ill, he adapted the same inner strength toward the invasive treatments. His positive attitude gave him a remarkable ability to maintain a normal work life in conditions where most others would simply shut down. Finally, when it was clear he was dying, he made it easy to be open about his situation. The first morning I walked into his hospital room, he asked me if I had been at the bedside of many dying friends. I knew he was telling me it was okay to be open in talking to him about his condition. It was an extremely generous gift. Bill was hospitalized in a substandard situation in New York. There he became accepting of various abusive and neglectful practices. I was surprised at how accepting he was. Then I realized it was protective behavior. He was going along in order to get along. He probably figured if he was no trouble, he would get as good care as they were capable of providing. Finally, his care conditions got so bad that it was decided to move him from New York to a hospice facility in San Francisco. The move required an overnight stay in a motel near the San Francisco airport. The next morning, five of us were involved in moving Bill from the motel room to a waiting station wagon. He could not walk, so we moved him in a chair from the motel room to the door of the station wagon. Because he was a big guy, it was not clear how best to maneuver him onto the front seat. His two sons, Eric and Alex, Izzy, a friend from New York, Matt, Bill's trusted colleague from work, and I were discussing different ways to proceed. Unfortunately, it was cold due to raw summer fog and chilling wind. The discussion went on too long. Finally, Bill had had enough. He had said almost nothing in the past day, and when he had spoken, it was very soft and hard to understand. Now, in a booming voice, he said, "Bernie, you shut up. Izzy, you shut up. Eric, you shut up. Alex, you shut up. Matt, you decide." It was a magic moment. My friend Bill had come alive, and he was expressing his own self-image to us. He was a problem solver till the end, and had taken charge of the situation. With his British accent, it was as though Dylan Thomas himself was telling us he would not be going gently into that good night. That was his great gift to us all. Your turn. Imagine you have only 10 minutes to live. What would you do? Imagine you have only 10 days to live. What would you do? Imagine you have only 10 months to live. What would you do? Imagine you have only 10 years to live. What would you do? Imagine you have only the rest of your life to live. What would you do? Looking at your answers to these questions, you have a lot of information about yourself. In this exercise, we're talking about your end game. Can you think of any changes you would like to design into your self-image? Start designing and changing. None of the friends I just told you about knew when they would enter the final countdown. I don't know when mine will come, and you don't know yours either. One thing for sure, it is closer today than it was yesterday, and it will be closer still tomorrow. So now is the time to develop into the person you want to be. Point of View Revisited. Story writers are concerned with different points of view. They classify them as an objective point of view, a third-person point of view, a first-person point of view, an omniscient point of view, and a limited omniscient point of view. In the objective point of view, the writer takes the position of a detached observer, never telling more than can be directly inferred from the dialogue and action. In the third-person point of view, the narrator does not participate in the action of the story. We find out about the characters through the narrator's outside voice. In the first-person point of view, the narrator is a participant in the story, and now the trustworthiness of the account is in question because it might lack objectivity. In omniscient accounts, the writer knows everything about all the characters and actions, or, in a more limited version, knows everything about a limited number of characters or actions. In real life, we get to write our own stories. Some people may be arrogant enough to think they can take on an objective or omniscient point of view, and some rare people might be dissociated enough from their lives to take on a third-person point of view. Some people have the delusion they can take on any point of view. Perhaps they can for brief moments, but most of us are all limited to a first-person point of view. And just as in fiction, the question of reliability arises. Because we are writing our own life stories in the first person, we need to realize that we give ourselves and all the other characters their meaning. There are many factors at play in determining your self-image. You can shape and redesign that image at will whenever it doesn't suit you. Whether that includes physical things like getting a haircut or losing weight, personality-based things such as correcting bad habits or improving skills, or changing pieces of your identity outright, like changing a name, it's important to know that your self-image doesn't have to stay stagnant. If you've defined yourself as lazy, a bad speller, messy, easily distracted, or selfish, that doesn't have to be an eternal part of your self-concept. You can make a decision right now to see yourself differently, and then to become different. The Big Picture. Chapter 9. Insanity in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epochs, it is the rule. Friedrich Nietzsche. Life, on every level, is full of complexity and uncertainty. As individuals, we face a life of unknown duration, during which we are likely to go through periods of family, career, or personal crisis. The world around us is even more unpredictable. I am always amazed that things work as well as they do. It's a very good idea to have a general sense of your goals in life, and an equally good idea not to get too rigid about your path. Stay open to possibility. Let other people in, and listen when new opportunities present themselves. Life as chance. My life seems to have been punctuated by a set of unforeseen detours, followed by surprising right and left turns, anything other than a series of planned, rational steps. This puts me in a difficult situation when students ask for career advice. I attempt to give it my best shot, which is a rational, linear extrapolation from the present to the future, though I know that the chance of what I say ever becoming reality is very slight. I sometimes tell students, life is an adventure, so loosen up. Stop trying to figure it out. Just go with the flow. This does not seem to satisfy most of them. So I play the sage, knowing full well their lives will soon deviate from any rational life path that they may have laid out. I don't have the time or audacity to tell the students how I ended up living and teaching at Stanford, but I will tell you here. My wife and I both grew up in the same New York City neighborhood near Bronx Park. Despite my inauspicious start as a lazy high school student who spent his time on the streets, I went on to college locally, where I nearly flunked out. The wake-up call I needed was the letter from the dean telling me that I was on academic probation. Wait, they can't flunk me out, I thought. I knew I wasn't stupid. From then on, I was a straight-A student. I learned to love school, and I wanted to continue, so I went on to graduate school. As a graduate student, I also began lecturing at City College, and teaching spoke to me. I really, enjoyed it. As I was nearing the completion of my PhD studies at Columbia University, I had a discussion with my thesis advisor about my future. To my absolute delight, he suggested I apply to join the Columbia faculty. He cautioned me that it would be prudent to also apply elsewhere because there was at the time some pushback about inbreeding in the mechanical engineering department. He mentioned that Cornell University was looking for a young assistant professor. I, in turn, recalled that several years back I had spent a summer in Los Angeles and heard that the area around Stanford University was a nice place to live. I asked if my thesis advisor knew anyone on the Stanford faculty. Yes, he knew Professor Arnold. Herein lies the tale of coincidences that got me to Stanford, where I have spent well over 50 years of my life. The International Conference for Teachers of Mechanisms was held at Yale University in March 1961 under the auspices of the National Science Foundation. The organizers of the conference mailed an invitation to Professor Arnold at Stanford University. At Stanford's Department of Mechanical Engineering, there were two people with the last name Arnold. John E. Arnold was a famous professor in both mechanical engineering and the business school. He was the founding head of the department's design division. Frank A. Arnold, on the other hand, was a lecturer associated with the thermosciences division, which was interested in the aerodynamics of flight, not mechanisms. The conference invitation mistakenly went to Frank rather than John. Not deterred by this obvious error, Frank accepted the invitation and attended the conference, where he met my thesis advisor. Thus, when my advisor wrote about me to his acquaintance, he was writing to the wrong person. Happily, this time, Frank passed the letter on to John. My advisor had a very strong reputation, and based on that, John Arnold invited me to come to Stanford for an interview. Meanwhile, I had received an offer letter from Columbia University. I had accepted the position of assistant professor and was to start that September. I was looking forward to teaching at Columbia, working closely with my thesis advisor. I was nevertheless glad to be offered a free interview trip to California. In late July, my wife and I arranged for a nanny to watch our two young boys and my 12-year-old sister, who lived with us, and we boarded a train for California. At Stanford, I was very impressed with John Arnold. I learned he had been a popular professor at MIT and had only been at Stanford a few years. The design division he had created was composed of three young faculty members at the beginning of their careers, and the atmosphere was very different from what I was used to at Columbia. John had a special slant on education and engineering that was influenced by his having studied philosophy before going into engineering. Most of all, I noticed a special twinkle in his eye that made me feel that it would be interesting to work with him. I was thus pleased when, after a half day of interviews and a lunch meeting, the chairman of the department told me they would be recommending me for a 3-year tenure track assistant professor appointment. That evening, the concern set in. My wife was very attracted to the area, and John Arnold and the job seemed appealing. However, I really liked New York, my thesis advisor, and Columbia. Besides, Columbia University was starting the fall semester in a month, and I had already accepted the appointment. What to do? If I did move to Stanford, I would be arriving in a month with a family and no place to stay. I put down a deposit for a house rental, knowing full well that the odds were I would forfeit the deposit and end up staying in New York. My wife and I agonized over this decision during the long train ride across the country back to New York. When I arrived back at Columbia, my thesis advisor asked what had happened, and I told him I had been offered the job. Without hesitation, he told me he had been discussing that probability with his colleagues and that they had heard that Stanford was going through a large building up of faculty. They believed Stanford was headed toward a new era and felt it would be in my best interest to accept the offer. Furthermore, I should not be concerned about my last-minute reneging at Columbia. In an instant, the problem with Columbia was resolved. That only left the task of informing our families that we were leaving and taking the children 3,000 miles away. And yes, my 12-year-old sister was horrified at the prospect of having to leave her girlfriends. I have had a long and satisfying career at Stanford. And it took a host of improbable events for me to get here in the first place. My life is punctuated by milestones that would have never happened except for the combination of unplanned and improbable chance events. Most people I know have similarly non-linear life trajectories. How about you? Have you had enough unexpected developments in your life to sign on to the life is a chance theory? If yes, learn to enjoy the trip and not waste your cross-country train ride worrying about what to decide. Opportunities. Some people almost never need to make agonizing decisions. Life for them just seems to flow along. And when the big transitions happen, they notice they were big only in hindsight. I am one of those people. I consider myself lucky to have had that type of a career. And thinking about the many crossroads in a long and full career, I now see that if I had not responded to certain opportunities, my life would have been quite different. I will never know, of course, what might have been. Still, I have no regrets. There are two extreme types of people in the world: those who say yes to every opportunity, and those who say no. I place myself in the middle. I have found that it's important to be mindful of my reactions to opportunities. There's no way to know in advance where these will lead. Some may lead nowhere, and some to disaster. Yet when opportunity presents itself, we have no choice but to respond. Ignoring opportunity is itself a response. Several life-changing opportunities have come to me in the form of out-of-the-blue phone calls. The first came in my second year at Stanford. I answered my office phone and was asked to hold. Dr. Terman wanted to talk. Of course, I knew the name. Frederick Terman was Stanford's provost, a legendary electrical engineer who had been the mentor of Bill Hewlett and David Packard. However, I had never met him. What could he possibly want with a young assistant professor? Terman informed me that he was calling to suggest that I provide some expertise in the design of machines to John McCarthy, a mathematician who had just won a large government grant to found the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. Part of the grant was to go toward the development of robotic devices. Terman had been told that John was too mathematical to handle the design of actual devices, and that I could provide necessary engineering skills. Terman's phone call led to my close collaboration with the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and my immersion in robotics, which became a major part of my creative work for over 40 years. I became one of the founders in the new field of robotics, and John grew to be a lifelong friend. He was one of the main creators of the field of artificial intelligence, a true genius with an incredibly inquisitive and creative mind. I soon found out he was much more practical than Terman had been led to believe. John had a charming belief that he could solve any problem. In the early days, I traveled with him to Houston, where the two of us met with oil company executives in a fancy conference room near the top of a large skyscraper. John was trying to convince them to fund the development of a robotic coal mining machine. We had never done anything remotely like that, but John described in detail what he imagined such an undertaking would accomplish. He showed a film our students had made of a robotic arm assembling a tower of blocks. The background music on the film was Scott Joplin's ragtime melody, The Entertainer, which had been used in the film The Sting. In the film, two hustlers, played by Paul Newman and Robert Redford, con a mob boss out of a lot of money. As I sat there, I realized John was not aware of the strong parallel between our fanciful request and The Sting's plot. We never got the money. To this day, I am sure the oil men saw the irony and had a good laugh. I remember that my initial reaction to Terman's phone call was at best neutral. At first, I felt that the opportunity presented was a distraction from my main research. However, it turned out I was able to bring my unique perspective to what John was doing, and the robotics work, in turn, enhanced my main area of interest, kinematics. Another phone call that changed my life was from my friend Mike Rabbins, a professor at Texas A&M University who wanted to know if I'd organize a summer creativity workshop. My immediate reaction was an emphatic, "No way." But just as I was about to hang up, I realized it could be a good opportunity for my friend Rolf Fasta to build up his reputation and get promoted. He and I wound up leading these workshops for 10 years. The opportunity I reluctantly accepted, for reasons that never materialized, Rolf never applied for the promotion, ended up having a major impact on me. Teaching methodology and experience-based learning became a big part of my life, and I had a new basis for interacting with colleagues throughout the world.